Group meeting, Friday, 15th April, 1983. Now, let us recall our last meeting in March. You remember we considered the statement that if one is seriously concerned with the religious life and its fulfillment, start from the other shore. And of course, naturally, the words as they stand mean that we are on this shore and we have to cross the stream or the ocean, as the case may be, till we reach the other shore. Now this is where we go a little bit astray, due mainly to the underlying defect of the misleading nature of words. Physically, yes, you have to start here in order to get there. But where the spirit is concerned, where the profound realities are concerned, there is no there or here. There is no yesterday, today, tomorrow. Everything is here now. Space, time are all concentrated here, right here now. This is something which is difficult to be conscious of. We hear the words, we read such things, we read lovely sounding phrases like the eternal now and so forth, which stirs us. But we are not really conscious of what it implies, what it means. You see, that's why I suggested, if I remember right, at all three meetings, that we try and meditate in the real sense, meditate on the nature of infinity and eternity. Eternity implies no past, present, future. And infinity implies no distance, no separation. That is an extraordinary thing. Because it's so difficult to get hold of it, simply because our ordinary everyday experience in life knows that we are constantly dealing with distance in space and with the passage of time. You see, now when you found that the trains, there you actually experienced what we at the material level would call the unquestionable reality of space and time. Because it is such a reality for us in our experience, mainly because we function through our senses and our brains. All the sense impressions are synthesized by the brain to form meaningful thought patterns, which we call knowledge. See, if we hear the next train is at 6:50, well, all those words have a very definite meaning for us, a precise meaning. And therefore we are limited to that. Because that is the way our senses and brains function. Now if we become conscious in terms of a new dimension, then we become free of some, if not most, of the limitations imposed upon us by the fact that we function in sense brain terms. Infinity, eternity are words which have such significance that they practically negate and in many instances wipe out all that is real to us in our practical daily life in terms of sense brain functioning. You see? Now, the value lies here. It is not that we want to sort of produce a particular type of philosophy or anything. Philosophy is useless, especially the modern sort of philosophical procedures. They are a drawback, really. They don't take us far. Because they don't deal with this extraordinary thing which happens in the human species, this evolution of consciousness. They don't deal with that. Now, if consciousness changes, undergoes this transformation, through meditating upon words like infinity and eternity, then the whole of our life undergoes an extraordinary transformation. I can only affirm this partly through experience, you see. But there are dangers inherent in saying that. Because, you see, somebody else's experience can never be a guide or an authority for you where the transcendent aspect of your being is concerned. It can be a guide if you are interested, say, in right dieting as a means of health, and I happen to be an expert on it, then what I say about it can be a guide for you, and quite a useful, practical, profitable guide. But where this transformation of consciousness is concerned, no other person can do it for you. But he can make suggestions in words, which of course you hear through your ears and then interpret with your brains, which may somehow stimulate you in such a way that your inner awareness, this thing which I call consciousness, true, pure consciousness, that changes. And when that changes, you live in this world as if in a world of your own creation. That is the extraordinary thing that happens. You realize what it implies. We sometimes say of a person who is, a little bit dreamy or full of fantasies, he makes his own world. He thinks he's creating his own world. He's not. He's merely making a mental picture using his imaginative faculty. And what is the imaginative faculty? It is an image-making faculty. Now, the image is not the real thing. If you made a little piece of sculpture of me, that is not this living fellow. That's just a lifeless image, however good it may be, however nice it may be. But again, if it is a good image in the real sense, and you see it, then if you see me in the street one day and you've never met me, you'll say, ah, there's that man. You see, so the image has helped. It's a little bit like that. So now, you create your own world in a very living and real sense in which you can live. And it will not be separated from, totally separated, from the actual environment in which you are. This is a very important point, because oneself and the environment are a unity. They form a single totality, a limited totality, because no one person's environment includes the entire universe. See? So it's our particular limited totality, which is our environment. We use the term our environment. Now you see the difficulty of language. When I say that, immediately the brain sees it as this fellow and his environment. You'd say, oh, this man and his books or his room, as something separate. Now the books and this fellow are separate, of course, true. You see? But the environment as a whole is not a separate thing in inner consciousness. They are one whole. Now in that way, you create your own world, which is not separate from the environment in which you live. But your understanding of the environment is, and of your own existential being, your own psychophysical organism, is completely altered in your innermost consciousness by realizing that its proper context is infinity and eternity, not space and time. You see? In that sense, you dematerialize your whole world by this enlightening, this lighting up in your own inner consciousness. So you see, and I mentioned that our task is to liberate transcendence out of its imprisonment in our existential being. And in order to do that, we necessarily go through an ascesis, not a laid down ascetic practice. Because whatsoever is laid down from you, for you from outside, is something which constricts you. It must not be laid down from outside. Whatever systems have been laid down, study them by all means. Consider them. But don't say, therefore, I ought to, from moment to moment, live, act, behave, think, feel like this and this and this, which is external to you. Because then you will just be like a toy in the hands of somebody. It's not that way. The ascesis you will be informed of that ascesis from within yourself, not from outside yourself. Do not reject out of hand anything that is outside. It has its place. But learn to discriminate between the real and the unreal, that which does apply to you yourself and that which applies to the other people around you and so forth. This is very important. Your discipline is your process of learning. Learning happily and growing therefore. Then you can't learn happily unless you have the truly creative element in you, because you are happy in creation. What is the happiness creatively that the whole animal world knows? Biological procreation. But this is not creation in the true sense of the term. This is procreation, just as the pursuit of various arts and producing lovely poems and music and all the rest of it, all the fine arts and so forth, and lovely buildings and whatnot and whatnot. That is cultural procreation. That is not cultural creation. It is related to something which has gone before, which has laid down the norms for the manner in which these things should be produced. For example, you have the word sonnet. A sonnet is just this type of poetry. You have a play, a drama. Well, it is just that type of writing. You have a novel. It is that type of writing, and so forth. It has emerged out of the past. There is nothing in it which is absolutely new, creative. And the real creative process is that which produces the completely new, which has never been there before. You see, it's like that. So now, this discipline, which is your learning process, is something which emerges out of you by sheer observation, open-minded observation, and I've forgotten the other thing. Inspiration. If your observation is really open-minded, then you will find true inspiration coming out of you yourself. I think you experienced that when you did that, didn't you, Andrew? I mean, you saw me sitting there, and somehow you had the inspiration and you produced it without my having to sit for him. He did it just like that. And I imagine that something like what I've said just now about the observation and the inspiration, it gives rise to true creation, you see. There are also, as I've said, there are certain things which are the heritage which we have from the accumulated knowledge of the race itself. In this process of releasing transcendence from its imprisonment in ourselves, there are certain things which we have to bear in mind. We have our bodies, as we call them. Well, now, the body is a material body, intertwined, interpenetrating, and interpenetrated by what we call the psyche. Actually, it is one organism which manifests both materially and psychically. Simultaneously, they are not separate. Every thought or feeling that we experience produces some sort of electrochemical process inside the body. I'm not putting it rightly. The electrochemical process in the body as such is associated immediately, absolutely, with the psychical state. They are not separate. It's not as if you got into a psychical state and then an electrochemical process took place. Nor is it a case of an electrochemical process took place and then you got into a psychical state. The two are simultaneous. But for talking purposes, we have no option but to talk dualistically. in terms of separation. This is our miserable drawback which we can never overcome during our lifetime. That if we do talk, we have to talk of the unitary whole in terms of duality and in terms of multiplicity. You see? But when you get to this point that you become truly creative from within yourself, that duality in consciousness will vanish. You will be conscious in terms of the wholeness of the whole thing. So now with respect to the body, since we are talking of the body, and talking entails the duality, what are the main aspects which produce the right askesis? Askesis meaning getting free of everything that is unnecessary. Now you as an artist in your own lines, you know that when you produce your work, you have to move out all that is unnecessary for what you want to release, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that is the meaning of askesis, the removal of all that is unnecessary. In our case, we inherit an enormous amount of unnecessary rubbish, and through our conditioning, especially where our psychical activity is concerned, and by psychical I mean our thoughts and feelings and ideas and language and what language does and all the rest of it, you see, it's all very much conditioned right from infancy onwards. And we have to become free of that. Now, in becoming free of what is unnecessary, do not think in terms of throwing it into the waste paper basket or into the dustbin or setting fire to it or destroying it. You can't do that. Because all that is unnecessary for the release of transcendence during our life, all that is unnecessary is psychophysical material which has got an ill expression, unhealthy expression. If you were to, if I have a pimple on my nose, I don't cut off my nose, do I? I'd look very pretty if I did. It's like that. You have to heal it. You have to make it whole. And in the making, and what are you making whole? Just that very material which has got an ill shape, which is ill expressed. So we have to bear that in mind. If we don't bear that in mind, we shall go through all the problems of conflict aroused by self-hate. And if I hate myself, it is impossible for me to avoid hating others and to spread hate in the psychical atmosphere in the world. I'm sure at least those of you who have reached more maturer years, and I think most of us have, you see, when we reach maturer years, we do see that that is the case, isn't it? Very well. If, therefore, we can be open-minded and observe quite openly, clearly, without attempting to destroy anything, then we will find that at the same time as we get free of any sort of hating, any sort of violence in us, this extraordinary thing we call compassion stirs. You know, the stirring of compassion, when it happens, is a very remarkable thing altogether. The world simply doesn't know the meaning of love. See, love for the world has meant attraction, attachment, possession, demand for sensational delight, and all the rest of the nonsense. That has nothing to do with love. Really caring for another takes place when in inner consciousness the separation between self and the other is out. When in inner consciousness that is the case, there is this extraordinary stir of compassion. This thrilling to the other's state, whether pleasant or unpleasant. You can be compassionate for the happy person just as much as you can be compassionate for the ill or the unhappy person. You see? It's like that. It is an extraordinary energy, psychical energy in ourselves, which manifests as real compassion. Commoner Garden, the dictionary meaning of compassion is to thrill in harmony with. And usually it means not just thrill in harmony with, but to suffer in sympathy with. Why is that the real meaning of compassion? Ordinarily the world would say, you don't need to have compassion for the fellow who is all right and happy and doing well and all the rest of it. But you see, the fellow who is happy, his happiness, this worldly happiness, this sensational delight happiness, is something which will come to an end. It will pass. And then he'll be unhappy. He will want to repeat the same experience, which is the way to collect a lot of burdensome material. You see? So one has to have compassion for the one who is being happy. We express great joy and so on when someone we know very well or some member of our own family has another child. We send congratulations and this, that and the other. True enough, but supposing that child turns out to be a Stalin or a Yorkshire Ripper or a Torquemada, or a confounded nuisance in some way or other to his environment. Supposing that is the case, we have expended our emotion in not in an altogether wise, practical manner, haven't we? We don't know. We express a feeling of sympathy for the person who has, the parents who have borne the child, and of course with the hope that that child will be, turn out a good human being. If we were absolutely certain that that child is going to be a dreadful villain and be extremely harmful to the human race, supposing we were certain beforehand, somehow or other, that it will be that, would we waste 16p upon a congratulatory letter? See, it's a little bit like that. It's rather difficult, isn't it? People would say, oh, this chap is not at all human talking like that. And he's not a god. Well, yes, of course I'm not a god, thank God. But we have to consider these things deeply, because by considering these things deeply, we do wake up to the significance and the process of this transformation of our inner consciousness. I've said this before, I'll say it again. When you become really conscious of love, compassion, or any of the virtues as such, whatever they are, when you become really conscious of it, then you are free of various ideas. And usually most people are quite wrong in their ideas about the true nature of love or compassion. You get free of that, and your whole life, in thought and feeling, in speech and action, will naturally and spontaneously express the reality of love and compassion. See, this is why it is so important to watch ourselves all the time. Be aware of what is happening, especially in here, in the brain, as we experience life from moment to moment. Particularly watch all one's fantasies. None of us can escape our fantasies. We can deliberately shut them out by various psychological techniques, meditational procedures and so forth. You can deliberately suppress them. But that is not the way. There's no release by deliberate suppression. None whatsoever. We think, there comes a time, if we practice deliberate suppression, there comes a time when we feel, now I'm free from that evil or something and so on. And I bet you can bet your bottom dollar that the very next day after you've had that feeling, some circumstance will arise so provocative that you will tumble down from the Eiffel Tower. You see, the life of the spirit, the religious life, the purely human life is no easy task. It's a tremendous task. It's a disappointing task in so many respects. And I say disappointing for this reason. How often people who strive to live the good life say to themselves at some time or other, good gracious, I have tried now for 40 years, 50 years, 60 years to do this, and this is all that happens. Now you see, I strove for 20, 40, 60 years with a personal objective in view. I wanted a particular kind of result to emerge. Now this is just ordinary selfishness. It's not for me to want any kind of result, whether I consider it good or bad. What I consider good, God may consider rotten, and vice versa. It's a strange thing. Now, why do I say and vice versa? For this reason. In terms of the totality, in terms of infinity, eternity, all our criteria don't hold. They just don't hold. But there is, if you like to put it in those terms, something which we may call an absolute goodness. Now there is a very remarkable teaching in the Gathas of Zarathustra, in which he teaches that virtue, the word used is asha, the Avastan words, asha, you see, has a core to it. The true core of asha. Asha means virtue, purity, righteousness. It also means the divine law. It is asha has several forms in Avastan, and if you study those forms, you will see that it is the identical conception which is involved in the Rig Vedic Ritta. The inherent law and order in everything. So asha means all that. And the core of asha is armaiti. Asha is masculine, the word itself. Armaiti is feminine. No, I beg your pardon. Asha is neuter. This is the interesting point. The word asha is neuter gender. The word armaiti stands for, you can translate it as transcendent love, you can translate it as devotion. Its first meaning is devotion. Very good. Now, Ahura Mazda, the Lord himself, teaches Zarathustra, Armaiti is the core of asha. But in order to release Armaiti into action, you have to fulfill asha, live the pure life. So, in that process of living the pure life, you can only start with your own conceptions of what is right, what is not right, you see, what is good, what is beneficial, what is harmful, what is not harmful, and so on and so on. Isn't that so? So you have to start on the dualistic plane that way. But if one starts that way with the clear understanding that it is done not just for yourself, but for the sake of the totality. You know how in Christian teaching, unto God the glory, not unto man. For man, the task. The glory is for God. And the kingdom is the kingdom of God, not of man. See, these are very interesting things. So, armaiti, which also represents compassion, is the core of virtue. You start by practicing virtue as we know it in our own limited dualistic way. All right? And that releases compassion. Remember, asha, virtue, is neuter. This is what absolutely caught my attention. The fact that it is neuter, that means actually it is not neuter in the sense of neutral, but it is androgynous. It's masculine, feminine. Now, if you look at virtue that way and see that devotion implies at its transcendent level the complete unconditional self-surrender to the divine. The complete unconditional and unreserved self-surrender to the divine. If that spirit is there, then asha, virtue, duty, law, order, in its transcendent sense, is released and becomes manifest in your life and in your environment, therefore. Because you and your environment are one. I hope that this may be of some use to you in understanding this business of the living of the good life. And then the good life can become absolutely good. It's neuter. It's masculine, feminine. The Kabbalistic teachings also have something very similar to all this.